Today I want to talk about a couple of different concepts, but they're interconnected. I want to talk about expression, and then I want to talk about the fear of feedback when we express ourselves and how those interrelate. For me, expression is another way of saying life. This ability to and willingness to express energy, that is, energy flowing to us and through us, our expression really is an indicating to the level of life that we are experiencing and willing to share with others. You can just imagine if expression is an energy flow to and through us, a person who is more alive has more energy flowing to and through them, and somebody who is dead, physically dead, has very little energy flowing to and through them. And in fact, the only thing energetic going on inside of that dead physical body is the deconstruction of it, the reduction of it to its elemental forms, if you will, decomposition. Expression is life. Now, if it's life, I want to talk about why we don't express ourselves more. What stops our expression? Now, we probably could talk about that for days and days and also write hundreds of books on it if they're not already written, but I want to make things a little bit simpler. And I, off the top of my head, boiled it down to about four different ideas that would say these are the reasons why we stop our own expression. First of all, we misbelieve, that is, we believe a lie. Number one, I have nothing of value to express. I don't have anything to express. I don't have any intelligences. I don't have any talents. I don't have any worth. That is a huge, huge lie. That's been sold in a lot of cases to us, and if we were unaware enough to buy it, we're stuck with that energy. But it is, in fact, a lie. Of all the people on the planet, all the people who ever lived on this planet, nobody is like us as individuals. Nobody has our experiences, our thoughts, our feelings, have walked in the steps that we've walked in, had all these energy exchange experiences that we've had, or had the family of origin that we had, had the sensibilities that we had. So, in other words, because of our uniqueness, we're valuable. We are expressions, in my opinion, of God, and this is how God is showing up in the world through each of us individually and all other things that exist. So that first excuse, we have nothing to express, is, I think, patently false. We could throw that out the window as not being valid. That's just an excuse if we buy that. The second thing that came to mind was the idea that we don't have the physical talents or capabilities, maybe even physically, to express ourselves. Well, I don't have a good speaking voice, or I don't have an attractive appearance, so I can't express myself this way. I can't draw, I can't paint, I can't sculpt, I can't design, I can't write. All those different things that we talk about. And, I don't have that and don't have this. That sounds like a legitimate reason, but it's actually just an excuse when you really consider the fact that a person like Helen Keller, with, if we would consider them handicaps, unbelievable of level of handicaps, and she was able to become world famous and an inspiration to millions of people, the author of books, how is that possible? We would look at her and say, wow, that she's starting way lower on the talent capability on a physical level scale than anybody we could imagine. Yet, she was able to express fantastically over the course of her life. So, number two is not a reason, it's an excuse. The third thing is when we perceive or think or look around and we use our limited experiences in lifetime and decide that nobody really cares about our experiences and our expression. Nobody is really interested in what we have to say or what we have to do or what we want to create or the things that interest us. No one cares. There are 6.5 billion people on this planet, and we haven't talked to them all. And one of the things that is most amazing to me about the internet is if you want to sell any one thing or you want to talk about any one idea, there are literally hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands upon thousands or hundreds of thousands of people eager to hear that expression. And then when you add in animals, I'm looking here at my 11-pound toy poodle, you look at all the dogs, all the cats, all the birds, all the other pets that people have, and you recognize that there are a tremendous number of beings who can serve us in this connection as we express ourselves. This universe has been defined or described by people as a two-terminal universe. That two-terminal is an electrical phrase, and that's the context. In order to have electricity flow, it requires two terminals. And so without two terminals, there's nothing to flow to. You have to have that. And so we could say that that's a love interest, that's a spouse, that's a child, that's a pet, that's a plant, that's a book we're writing. It could be anything we conceive of as that second terminal, and then we can express our energy to it. So three is not a valid reason. It's just an excuse, and I think we can throw that out the window as well. Which brings me to the fourth point on this list, fourth and final one. We are in fear of the reactions of other people to our expressions. We're in fear of the feedback that we're going to get from other people if we express ourselves. So, what is this express ourselves? What does that mean? I think it's kind of threefold if you were to look at it. And there are some people who are hearing this recording might be able to relate to this. I've certainly heard it enough times to recognize it is a valid concern. Is my very physical being, my existence, provoked negative feedback from people? Obviously, parents in most cases. They didn't want me. I was unexpected. I was a financial, emotional, physical hardship. It was a difficult labor, and on and on and on and on. So physically existing provoked negative feedback from a parent. And if you were to look at that, it's as if the parent is blaming the child for existing when, wait a minute, didn't you participate in some sort of physical activity and for me to physically exist? Well, how did I get the blame for it? How are you interpreting it that I'm the one that made you unhappy because I was conceived? What were you doing at that time? The other area where we get a lot of negative feedback over the course of our lives, and certainly early on, is in the area of doing. So it's not just being that some of us experience that negative feedback, but in the area of doing. Don't do that. Don't do that. I said no. Don't do that. Don't touch that. Don't do this. Don't do that. Those kind of feedbacks in regard to a child's natural desire to explore physical reality, let me touch, let me put it in my mouth, let me touch it, let me feel it, what is it, let me smell it, is to think that a child is not going to do that. The only way a child wouldn't do that would be if that child had the expression level, let's say, of a stone, a rock, just sat there. Now, from a convenience standpoint, that sounds, oh, my child is so well-behaved, they just sit there. But after about a day of that, we'd start to become very, very worried about that. My child just sits there. Not curious, doesn't investigate, doesn't... that we wouldn't be interested in having that child as a standard part of our lives. We would be in tremendous fear that something was wrong with that child. And we would recognize that as a significant problem. So this area of doing this, we make it wrong. And so the phrases like, oh, that's the terrible twos, oh, that's the terrible threes, which is another way of saying, my child is exploring. They seek to discover. Their little information knowledge sponges. They want to touch this and smell that and bite this and see what everything is about. They're very inquisitive. They're so curious. They want to learn. They want to learn. Every one of those is a great, great thing. What do? We label it. We mislabel it terrible twos and terrible threes. Because what? It makes us be a little bit more responsible for the child-proofing of the environment. But we make them wrong. We make their expression wrong. And then, the third area besides being and doing, and we arrive at having. This is an area that a lot of people find fault with, get a lot of negative feedback. the poor blame the rich for being rich, and so now the poor are angry about that, and in some cases it might be legitimate when the playing field is so unleveled, so unfairly and justly tilted in to disadvantage them and advantage another group. But here we have the rich who are going, I'm afraid of negative feedback from my having. I got to hide it from the government. I have to hide it from the poor people, lest they attack me, mug me, rob me, kill me, whatever, whatever. It's this fear of having. Just because you have that car, you think you own that road? People have heard that about Cadillac owners, 50 years ago, and it's like, wow, what is that? What is that? Their having is why I'm unhappy. Because they have, I'm unhappy. Because they do, I'm unhappy. Because they be, I'm unhappy. No, that's not accurate. That's not accurate. Unhappiness is the creation of the person who is unhappy. The person experiencing unhappiness created that unhappiness by using environmental signals, interpreting and twisting and filtering and concluding in certain ways. But we don't know that. We haven't known that. We overlooked that idea. If you really look at what feedback is not like looking in a mirror. And you look in the mirror and you see your reflection, and if the mirror is well manufactured, the reflection you see is going to be accurate. If it were a circus mirror, for instance, in which a thin person was made fat and a fat person was made thin, a short person made tall, those kind of mirrors that are designed to be funny but deliberately distort the reflected image. The people who provide feedback to us are more like the distorted mirrors than they are a well-manufactured, perfectly reflective surface. They are reflecting from their own filters, from their sense of balance or imbalance, their mis-emotional state, depending on what is going on in their lives. You know that if I were in, and you were in, the emotional state of, say, acceptance and peace, and somebody bumped into us, we would smile at them. However, if you and I were in pride and somebody bumped into us, we would try to minimize them. If we were in anger when somebody bumped into us, we would try to stop them. If we were in fear when somebody bumped into us, we would either go into attack, fight, or back off in fear, which we call flight. And if somebody bumped into us while we were in the state of shame, we would think it was our fault for occupying space. And so you just look at those scenarios and you go, wow, all the interpretations there were about the same event. And so the difference in one event from the next to the next to the next was the interpreter. That is, the person who interpreted those environmental signals. Not the person who did the bumping. Not the person who did the bumping. That's a very important point. So how do people express their unhappiness? When you make somebody, and that's so inaccurate, you don't make anybody unhappy. You don't make anybody unhappy other than yourself. Neither do I. But we've been taught to believe that our being, doing, and having does make other people happy. So instead of walking on the boulevard of life and just enjoying things and enjoying the sights and sounds and the smells and the tastes of life, we have now converted that into a tightrope, and we very, very carefully tread on this very narrow path for fear that we'll cause somebody unhappiness, we'll hurt their feelings, we'll make them angry, we'll do something bad or sinful or wrong. So how do people express their feedback to us? Silence? Withdrawal? A look? Scolding? Physically hitting or being abusive? Fault-finding? Sarcasm? Jokes that you know are not jokes? They hurt, they sting, outright anger, rage, all of those things, I bet everybody here has experienced one way or another, perhaps felt some of them, if not all of them, personally. And those are the tools that people use, like cattle prods, to control other people. If you do X, that will make me unhappy. Sometimes we use phrases as parents. I would be really disappointed if you got anything less than an A. I'd be really disappointed. That hurt me. Oh, it hurts me when you don't write or you don't call, right? All of that kind of use of unhappiness in order to control, produce a sense of guilt, give an image of guilt or regret to the other person, so that if they don't behave in a certain way, they'll be uncomfortable, and so they'll have to be in the way, they'll have to behave in the way that we want. So we're controlling them. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. I went to a soccer game last night. There's a statewide, Florida-wide soccer tournament going on up in the Tampa area. I watched a game between two teams of 11-year-old girls, one from Tallahassee and one from the eastern part of the state. It was very interesting to me. I don't know a lot about soccer, but I do know a lot about playing sports, and I think I know a lot about human behavior. And what I witnessed were two teams operating with two different goals. The team from Tallahassee was focused on what they were trying to accomplish. And when you play soccer, pretty much everybody agrees that what you're trying to accomplish is kicking the ball into the net on the opposite end, on the opponent's end of the field. That's what you're trying to do. Your what is to kick your ball into the net on the opponent's end of the field. The other team seemed to be operating with a different goal. They were more concerned with what looked like how. And that how was how to avoid making a mistake. They were much more tentative. They were holding back. They had their foot on a brake as instead of letting go, as like, you know, rambunctious 11-year-old girls running up and down the field. They were holding back. Instead of kicking the ball powerfully or dramatically or in a big way, they were just edging it along, little teeny bumps, little bitty kicks, just trying to avoid what looked like a mistake, figuring almost that if I only make a little kick, I can only make a little mistake. If I make a big kick, wow, that really opens me up to negative feedback about the big mistake that I made. And I just watched this game play out like that. Instead of playing with abandon, they played by having the foot on the brake pretty much the whole game, ended up losing 2-0. It was like, wow. When I look at something like that in a sports environment, or in a business environment, or in a family environment, or in a military environment, I've been in all of those, I recognize when there is ineffective behaviors or functioning or play, I look to management to determine the cause. On a sports team, I look to the coaches. What values have they dramatized, have they emphasized to their players? And if it's don't make a mistake, that's a real problem. On the other hand, if I were talking about a problem in the military with soldiers, I would look to their senior officers to find out where the decisions were made that resulted in poor results. Where's the fault in leadership? And it's there, in my opinion, every single time. Employees in a corporation that are ineffective or unhappy, I look to management. When I was in that world, Fortune 500 corporation, it was very clear to me it was management. It was a management problem, not an employee problem. And when misbehavior occurred in family, even my family of origin, it was management. And my own family, when my children were having difficulties or struggling, it was their management, their parents. And when we start looking there, instead of blaming the people who are experiencing mismanagement or misvalues or this overlay of control or fear of feedback for their behaviors, for their being or doing or having, we can really put ourselves in a position of solving a lot more of the problems rather than blaming the results of the problems for the problem as compared to the causes of the problem for the problem. I think there's a real value personally of knowing how to do something effectively and how to do it ineffectively. How to do it, quotes, right, and how to do it, quotes, wrong. If we know that, I think we're in a much better position to know how wide the boulevard is, how wide the path is, and we know what the margin of error is. About 8 years ago, I was working on the bottling line for a weekend at my wife's winery. And as a small winery, they, and this is true for lots of small wineries, if not all of them, is they can't afford this equipment for the bottling line, which is used for a two-day period or a three-day period once a year. And so they bring in a mobile bottling line. So what happens is on a given day, after all the empty bottles, the labels front and back, all the corks, all the foils that cover the top of the bottle, and people are brought in, volunteers and friends and some paid, to work the bottling line, a trailer, tractor-trailer kind of a rig pulls up. The sides fold down, and the back folds down, and then, lo and behold, inside looks like the beginning. It looks not the beginning. It looks like the entire bottling line that you would see inside of a building, except this one, it drives from winery to winery to render service. So then, when everything is in place, they hook up hoses to huge tanks containing the wine that's about to be bottled. And so empty bottles get fed into this line and then filled with wine, and then cork is put in, and then the foil is put on top, and then the foil is crimped, and it labels put on the front and then on the back, and it comes off the bottling line, and a person takes the bottles and puts them in the case and fills the case, puts the case on a pallet, and those pallets, when they're loaded with 56 cases, are then moved with a forklift and put on a truck, shipped to a storage facility that's bonded, licensed and bonded in California. This is the point. I've worked on various spots or places in this bottling line, and you change every couple of hours so you wouldn't be bored, and also it made it more interesting. So there I was with the bottles would come out right after the cork was put in, right after they were filled, and I'd put the foil on top, and then it would be crimped. Foil on top, crimped. Foil, crimped. Foil crimp. And I realized that sometimes they were misaligning and they were crimping wrong. So I was making a mistake. Most of them were right, obviously. They were, well, obvious to me that they were right, but then some of them were wrong. And I didn't understand how I was doing it wrong. I just saw the result. Oops, that's not what I wanted. It was wrinkled. That doesn't look professional. And so when I discovered how to do it wrong, how to be ineffective at doing it, I saw that little teeny subtle change, that little teeny subtle positioning difference between effective and ineffective. As soon as I saw that, I knew how wide the path was, and then I was able, boom, right, correct, effective, each time. And it was very interesting to me to recognize that I became much more effective when I knew how to do it wrong, not just how I knew how to do it right. Now I had the full range, almost like being able to drive down the highway, and you can see the marking on the lanes, and you know, if I pulled off into the weeds at 60 or 70 miles an hour, yeah, that would be considered ineffective. And if I pulled into somebody else's lane on the left, yep, that would be considered ineffective. So I know the boundaries of that behavior when I'm driving a car, because it's clearly marked, the parameters, the perimeters, the limits of that behavior. But in so many of our other behaviors, like on the bottling line, there was no marking. I had to discover it. And when I discovered it, I realized, oh, that's what I would have liked to have done. And last night when I was watching that soccer game, I thought, I would love to work with these girls for a couple of hours to show them rights and wrongs. And then dispel the idea that there's a right and a wrong. There's effective and ineffective. And kicking the ball into the net, that's the most effective. Letting somebody kick the net, the ball into your net, that's most ineffective. Everything in between is a level of effectiveness. And it's about playing, not doing it right. It's about playing and let go. And I think it would be a totally different experience. It would be a totally different experience to help them define what effectiveness is when they're in the middle of the field and off to the side of the field, or throwing the ball in from out of bounds and all the rest of this, as compared to holding some sort of a standard of rightness and don't make a mistake or I'll yell at you, that so many athletes and so many people and so many employees and so many children are hogtied, fearing. Fearing feedback, to me, has become similar to the idea that I experienced as a child. That is, fearing the boogeyman in the closet. And when I wasn't afraid of him in the closet, it was because I was afraid of him having sneaked underneath the bunk beds. And so that's where he was hiding. So this fear of the unknown, the fear of the dark, this fear of somebody can do me harm kind of thing, I think is, I don't know if it's universal, but it's pretty prevalent. So fearing negative feedback is like fearing the boogeyman. And you go, fearing the boogeyman. I don't know how you dealt with your fear of the boogeyman, or frankly, whether you had one at all. I know how I handled it. One night, I became so tired, so unhappy with fearing the feedback or the threat of the boogeyman, I challenged him to come out of the closet. I dared him. I dared him to come out. And so, having done that, and stayed with it for a couple of minutes. I mean, it wasn't like, come on out, I dare you. It was an in-your-face, angry, boy, oh boy, I am so tired of you. Get, use some rude words, which I've known since I was very, very young. And guess what? The threat did not materialize. The threat did not materialize. There was no boogeyman. Wasn't one in the closet. There's not one under the bed. But that hasn't stopped me from taking that boogeyman scary energy and putting it into this area of feedback. I don't want them to not like me. I don't want them to say unkind things to me. I don't want them to be unhappy with me. I don't want to cause them unhappiness, as if that were even possible. We buy that idea, but it's not possible. People sell us that idea for control purposes and manipulation to get what they want, but it's not possible for us to make another person unhappy. I think there's value here in recognizing that these ideas of the boogeyman and feedback are essentially the same energies. The way to deal with the boogeyman is to open the closet and look deeply into the darkness to see what it is. And it's nothing but an illusion. It's just a made-up idea. It's imagined. Dale Carnegie, in his second most famous book, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, talks about worry. The way to deal with worry, and one of his principles is decide, define, what's the worst that could happen? What is the worst that could happen? How bad can the boogeyman be? How bad can the feedback be? And when you do that, everything starts to shift. And it seems to me that this is 50 or more years before Hans Selye defined stress as the nonspecific response to a demand placed upon the body. That Dale Carnegie was saying, make it specific. You're worried about this boogeyman? You're worried about this thing that may never occur? In fact, over 80% in his point of view, is the things we worry about never, ever occur. So we're worrying about so many boogeymen that they're never going to happen. And he is saying, make it specific. Instead of having a non-specific response, make it specific. Define it. Define what this is. Then all of a sudden it's like, okay. I have a pretty good chance of surviving that. Okay, now that brings it into perspective, which is really what we're looking to do, is to be able to bring this into perspective so it doesn't overwhelm or dominate us. When the fear of feedback overwhelms or dominates us, our ability to express ourselves is so limited, so suppressed, so held back, so tentative, that the beauty that would otherwise flow through us doesn't happen. And we experience it. I talked about the ideas of how people show unhappiness. Those are the kind of unhappinesses when we hold back our own expression, we're going to display. We're going to display unhappiness by finding fault with other people's being, doing, and having. We're going to find fault with them. We're going to blame them for our unhappiness. We're going to go, everybody else is going to be responsible for how we feel. But it's our unwillingness to express. It's our unwillingness to live, to participate in life and grow, that is causing our unhappiness. Is negative feedback really that negative? Perhaps. Perhaps. We've certainly experienced it in which there were painful moments. No doubt about it. But on the other hand, I believe there is no shortage of value in negative feedback. Because that negative feedback, the negative is, that was not what I was expecting. Exactly. But over time, then all of a sudden you recognize, wow, that really did serve me. Hurt when it happened, because it was a change of state. It was different than I expected. It was not how I was thinking of things. I didn't want to feel that. But having felt it, I'm better off for it. Thanks for that feedback. I can recall when I was in the 7th grade, one lunchtime, somebody slammed a door while I was leaning back against in the gym, and it pinched the end of one of my fingers right off. Scared me, hurt like heck, bled like crazy, ran to the doctor. He decided not to stitch it up because it would heal better if just left to its own. And so wrapped it in the bandage and so on. I dramatized this like this was the most gigantic wound. It was big, but it wasn't gigantic. And so my boo-boo, and I'm babying myself and self-pitying myself, and everything is about my boo-boo, my boo-boo, my boo-boo, my boo-boo. And one day, my homeroom teacher, who, to me, lacked compassion, and I'm not the only one that sensed that, but that was valuable on this particular case. I was doing something, and I took it off, and she saw this dime-sized blue scab formed on the end of my finger, and said to me, is that all it is? The way you talked about it, I thought you had lost your entire finger. I was humiliated. I was humiliated. I put that back on my finger, stopped feeling sorry for myself, stopped using it as an attention-getting device. Poor me, poor me. I said, she shocked me. I didn't like her. I don't think I liked her before that, but I definitely didn't like her after that, because she wasn't pitying of me, I suppose. That feedback was tremendously valuable. How do you know a boo-boo is just a boo-boo and it's not a significant thing? I don't know. The fact of the matter is, that teacher had two children, a girl and a boy. The boy was born with a deformed arm. So one of his arms, his right arm, only grew to just past his elbow. So he had a little bit of forearm, but he had no hand. No wrist, no anything. Just right past the elbow, he had a stump. So compared to him, my boo-boo was like infinitesimally small. And her feedback was based upon her perspective, and it served me later on. It served me when I got over the humiliation of being called out and having a mirror reflect to me exactly what I was doing, which I was unaware of. My mother was a nurse. Having a boo-boo is, that's the way you get an attention in a family with seven children. She straightened me out, my teacher, and I am grateful for that. I am thinking that negative feedback is pretty much a way for us to reinterpret it as protective. If you were to look at a pea that grows on a bush in a garden or a farm lot, that pea has a pod. That pod restrains the expression of that pea. It also protects that pea. It keeps that pea from being exposed, from expressing itself openly until it is ready. A coconut shell could be seen as that same way. It confines, it imprisons, it protects. That husk and that shell makes it much more viable. When it comes time to express, that is, when it's ripe, it is going to express much more effectively and successfully. And you can look at plants, and you can look at the husk on a seed. You could look at all this and go, When we got negative feedback, if it caused us to develop more by looking inward, not, they were mean, that's focused on the problem. But if it caused us to hold on and develop and become grounded and more aware and more mature in our expression, then when it becomes time to blossom, to express in the world in our fullest, highest potential way, that negative feedback, that shell, that imprisonment, that would have kept us from expressing prematurely and being damaged as a result of it. This kind of feedback can really serve us if we're willing to look deeply into it and see if it really has served that. Oftentimes in success books, it talks about this idea. When you have an idea about which you're passionate, keep that idea to yourself. Keep that idea to yourself. Don't get, I got a great idea, I got a great business idea, this is so great, and then you run and tell members of your family, your friends, and anybody who will listen to you, and as soon as you run into that'll never work, that's a lousy idea, I think that's been done twice and it failed both times, you get that expression prematurely will cause that fire, that spark, that hope, that inspiration to die. And so the advice is, don't expose that prematurely. Don't express it prematurely. Hold on to that energy pattern until you feed it, you nurture it, you let it morph into different shapes and different sizes, and you tweak it a little here and you tweak it a little there until it is really the creation you have in mind. Now, when that is much more clear to you, that's when you can express it. Walter Russell, a modern-day Leonardo da Vinci in America, been dead for some years now, and you can read about him, the man who tapped the secrets of the universe, by going to philosophy.org. That's a site devoted to his teachings. He's an amazing, amazing man, would say, when you have an idea, when you have a question, you can go to the source of all knowledge. He's not talking about information, not going to the library, not buying a book. He's talking about going to the source of all knowledge, which is one of the ways he described God. You go there with the idea, you go there with a question, and when that energy comes into focus, when it becomes clear to you how it needs to be expressed, you express it in your day-to-day physical life. You take steps to express it. He said, why would you express something that's not fully formed energetically already or spiritually? You're going to bump into walls because you're not seeing what to do. So when this is formulated so clearly, then it makes it a done deal. Walter Russell is the guy who invented cooperative housing, co-ops. You heard of condos, you heard of co-ops. He's the guy that invented that concept. He was doing real estate development in New York City. This is a guy that was born in the Midwest and stopped education at age 3, or not education, how about schooling? Dropped out of schooling at when he was 9 years old. I think that's about third grade or so. And he was doing real estate development, and he said one day to insurance people and bankers and real estate people that he wanted to do what he labeled as cooperative housing. He described it. Bankers said, cannot be done, cannot be done. Real estate people said, nope, that's impossible. Insurance people said, nope, it's impossible. That feedback meant nothing to him because he said, of course it can be done. I've already seen it. And he implemented it, and he was successful. He thinks the original intention, which is balance, fairness, exchange, was violated by the greed of real estate people and others participating in it, bankers and so on. But the concept is valid and viable. He knew it. He knew it because he saw it. He saw it in a completed form when he was engaged in the source of all knowledge. So this feedback didn't really mean anything because he recognized the feedback was coming from people who were unaware, who hadn't seen what he had seen. He knew, they didn't know. And so, I don't know. It's like, yeah, okay, you don't know. So I'm just because you don't know, because you're not aware, because you haven't seen it, doesn't mean it's not valid. You haven't seen it. That's why you think it's not valid. I'm telling you it's valid. And he implemented it. So this idea that we worry about feedback is we think we live through feedback. Oh, I hope they like me. I hope they like me. I hope they like me. That attention, while it's normal and it's natural and it feels good, it really is controlled by the person who has the attention. When they feel good, much like that little scenario I went through a little while ago with you, the idea that if I'm in acceptance and peace and you bump into me, the feedback you're going to get from me is going to be a smile and I'm going to be pleasant about it. But if I'm in anger and you do that, then it's not going to be pleasant, either for you or for me. And if I'm in fear, it's not going to be pleasant for me. And if I'm in shame, it's going to be even less pleasant for me. And it's like, whoa, you know what? If I'm looking for feedback from a guy who can go from shame through apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, pride, courageousness, acceptance, and peace, and I have no control of where he happens to be standing at any one moment, and I have no control over how he processes information and the quality, vibrationally, of the feedback he offers me, why would I want to make my happiness contingent upon this guy's very unpredictable, very changeable, volatile emotional states? You wouldn't. You wouldn't. Your connection, my connection, really is to our source. It is that source that is seeking expression through us. And when we look at how we express it, I think we can pretty much determine my expression is related to my emotional state. If I'm in anger, I'm busy trying to stop things from happening or stop them from ever starting. That's not creating. That's stopping. That's different. That's different. War is not about creating. It's about stopping. It's about destruction. And so you look at it, Godness, spirit, life force, our creative, this creative energy is seeking expression through us. What are we going to do? How are we going to express that? And that's shaped by our intention and our attention. We're the creators of our own happiness. And if we're focused on our happiness and we're not focused on our fear of our beingness or our doingness or our havingness, then we're going to be much more geared to our happiness, expressing things in harmony with happiness. What we're liable to attract is happiness-inducing energies. We'll send them out, we'll be replenished. If we operate from fear, we're going to attract that. We operate from unhappiness, we're going to attract more of that. I would say that if we look at the feedback that we have received over the courses of our lives, like they were boogeymen in the closets, we will recognize that when our parents provided negative, harsh, quotes, unjustified feedback, it was because they were misemotional. They were on a less than optimum state. They were not in courageousness, acceptance, or peace. And then we can be compassionate because they were in more pain than we were when they expressed that. Secondarily, we could evaluate, we could reinterpret, we could look at and be open to the possibility that that feedback, much like my seventh grade teacher, actually served us by preventing premature expression. Kind of like Walter Russell. He knew enough, he was wise enough on a lot of levels to be able to go to the source of all knowledge, and before he implemented anything physically, he saw it in completed form. We don't do that, generally speaking, specifically speaking, but we recognize that this kind of resistance, this negative feedback, is a protective shell, like on the outside of an egg. Before that chicken is ready to break out of that shell serves that chicken. May look like a prison, but it's more protection. Later on, it could be prison. I say that we stand here today, in this year, with an opportunity to convert these experiences of negative feedback into the propellant, into life-enhancing, frankly, life-saving behaviors. Not unlike when our parents said, don't play in the street. It was not just an idle rule because they were trying to exhibit tremendous control, but that there's real danger playing in the street where there's car traffic. And so if we can look at being held back with negative feedback, and if we use that opportunity to look deeper and develop a greater sense of ourselves in our spiritual rootedness into the source of all knowledge, into a relationship with the Creator, now, this year, and the rest of the years of our lives, when we want to express, we can have the most positive of intentions that we can manifest, because we recognize we've been served by these previous experiences. And instead of being in fear and trying to avoid, now we're in a place where we can create our own happiness and by extension model it for other people so they know they too can create their own happiness. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the Creator in connection to all that is, thank you for supporting us with your life force. Help us to understand that our expression of you is everything in life. It's what life is about. And when we go into fear, help us to get back into balance. When we go into any lower vibration, help us to trigger the need, the desire, the awareness that we need to get back into balance by aligning with you expressing through us. The energy that we express has got to be yours, since you are everything. Help us to know that we are part of your everything. And the joy that comes from that knowingness, that comes from that beingness, that comes from that doingness and havingness. You're the source of everything, and we're part of you. Thank you. It is so. Amen.